Welcome to the weekly Metacast Roundup from Personalized Intelligence. We take a step back from the daily noise to synthesize the key developments shaping our world.
Something to flag here, each day we deliver focused daily digests, and this is where we connect those individual thrusts into a coherent strategic overview.
This week, we're consolidating insights from April 13th through the 18th, 2026. It's been a week of recalibration, a subtle but significant shifting of tectonic plates beneath the surface of global power dynamics.
It felt like a week where strategies were less about doing and more about preparing to do. A period of feints and parries, establishing advantageous positions before the heavier engagements.
Consider this, we've seen a clear trend emerge regarding U.S. foreign policy, and we'll start there. The focus is moving away from direct military confrontation, specifically with Iran, and towards a strategy of economic coercion as the primary tool.
It's a calculated retreat, not a weakening. A shifting of the battlefield, leveraging financial pressure as a more sustainable form of engagement.
Then we'll examine how companies, Block being a prime example, are fundamentally redesigning their internal structures. They're building AI-driven world models that are actively changing how they perceive and value their own assets.
A fascinating revaluation informed by predictive analytics. It's like understanding your opponent's weaknesses before the bout, allowing for a more targeted and efficient defense and offense.
Following that, we'll delve into the escalating geopolitical competition for compute capacity, the literal horsepower driving AI dominance. Scarce resources are becoming the core battleground.
The foundation of any future advantage. Control the compute, control the narrative, control the future.
And finally, we'll close by unpacking Iran's strategic acceptance of economic pain in pursuit of regional leverage, a deliberate escalation of control over vital energy flows. Let's begin with the U.S. strategic pivot. $100 billion. That's roughly the GDP of Portugal, flowing every month into state bank interventions. Seriously, Alex, what are we even calling this anymore? It's not stimulus, it's directed force.
Directed force is a fair assessment, Maya. It's a consequence of what's unfolding with China, a China shock too, driven by overcapacity incentivized by aggressive industrial policy and critically currency devaluation. Beijing isn't playing by conventional rules. They're prioritizing global market share, deploying a policy lever Western economies significantly underestimated. It's a systemic shift in how trade dynamics operate.
Underestimated is generous. Volkswagen granting autonomy to its Chinese units isn't a business decision, it's a surrender.
The data tells a story. This isn't corporate realignment, it's a consequence of that surge in production. And it's not neutral capacity. China is strategically pressuring nations, appealing to Spain to block EU competition policies, signaling direct interference in European trade. It's a deliberate effort to undermine the bloc's independence.
So everyone just takes it. Because the energy markets recovered so quickly after the Iran situation, it feels like we all collectively shrugged.
That's the critical point. The quick recovery suggests the U.S. subtly lowered the geopolitical risk threshold without triggering systemic panic. This risk absorption connects to a parallel pivot away from direct military engagement, towards leveraging economic pressure, controlling critical shipping lanes like the Strait of Hormuz, for example.
The managed naval blockade. You mean the one that wasn't a failure because it succeeded by being low-key?
We can trace that further. It wasn't a deterrence failure, but an intentional calibration designed to motivate concessions from Iran while simultaneously encouraging European allies to take greater ownership of the crisis. The oscillation between pressure and negotiation isn't erratic. It reflects a belief that sustained disruption within manageable limits is more effective than overt conflict.
Okay, so we're deliberately poking at things, assuming the system won't break. That feels optimistic.
It's predicated on the reliability of established safeguards, the transferability of bonds to commodities, consistent support of the global trading system, but that foundation is eroding. Trump's tariffs and withdrawals demonstrated the potential for abrupt policy shifts, leaving countries like Saudi Arabia vulnerable. This creates a fucked up, you trusted us dynamic, prompting a scramble for self-sufficiency.
And Peter Thiel is recommending everyone just buy Intel.
Not just Intel, though that's a very visible example. He advocates for a production for security investment strategy, acquiring companies vital to U.S. domestic production, particularly in energy and the nuclear sector. The focus is actively shifting towards national choke point identification and weaponization.
So Liberation Day tariffs, a trade war, and now everyone building their own supply chains. What a success story.
Ironically, the Liberation Day tariffs inadvertently incentivized China's rare earth export controls. Fishman highlights that it spurred China to retaliate, representing a comparable choke point. This prompted allies like European nations to seek sovereign clouds and financial independence, preparing for a deglobalized world.
Choke point identification and weaponization. It sounds like a dystopian board game.
It is, in essence.
Recognizing potential disruption, European nations are seeking strategic autonomy. This accelerates a broader arms race, not of conventional weaponry but of economic power. The willingness of nations to extract a toll for market access, China for industrial products and rare earths, the US for consumer access, highlights a fundamental shift in geopolitical leverage.
A toll? You mean everyone's just shaking people down now?
Effectively, yes. It's not a return to bipolarity, but a fractured landscape where economic access is explicitly contingent on political concessions. And that landscape is increasingly built on information. The value of accurate analysis and the control of its flow undergoes a parallel transformation, driven by artificial intelligence.
Oh, great. Now we're outsourcing our geopolitical strategy to algorithms.
The US government is allocating investment at a scale comparable to the post-9/11 boom, stemming from an assessment that AI is rapidly displacing senior professionals, potentially rendering their analytical roles obsolete within 4 to 5 years.
4 to 5 years? That's terrifyingly specific.
The assessment focuses on the speed of AI's capabilities and the compression of knowledge work. Wealth is concentrating at the point of computation, even as policymakers demonstrate a willingness to manipulate data, BLS numbers, inflation reports, to prioritize stock market performance.
Wait, you're saying they're faking the numbers?
Prioritizing is a better framing. Tyler Neville details a textbook playbook involving reducing coupon issuance, distorting data, and flushing out CTAs to rebuy assets, acknowledging the harm to the lower class but showing no care for it. Supporting this prioritization is the manipulation of key economic indicators.
Okay, that's a policy choice. A terrible one, but a choice. What about everyone else?
That's where the Treasury situation comes in. The shift from US Treasuries to sovereign supranational and agency bonds isn't simply about yield, but escalating perceptions of US policy and credit risk, fueled by events like the Liberation Day incident and even the threats to Greenland.
Threats to Greenland? That was a thing.
It was a signal. China's state banks intervene at roughly $100 billion per month, reducing reliance on external financing and shifting U.S. Treasury demand towards leveraged basis trades. This means the U.S. no longer simply competes for economic dominance. It bets on its ability to selectively manage disruption, control information flows, and maintain market confidence through increasingly precarious means. Established partners systematically explore alternatives, and the tools used to secure stability, faith in U.S. economic data become liabilities.
So it's all fragile. Like a stained glass window held together by willpower and a lot of strategically placed tape.
An excellent analogy, Maya. The individual pains, the established financial institutions, the supply chains, the trade agreements are beautiful, but the entire structure is reliant on a delicate balance of forces. A single crack, a deliberate pressure point, can send the whole thing tumbling.
All right, so what should we be watching? Specifically?
The upcoming Section 301 review. The tariffs and the accompanying political signaling will reveal whether the U.S. intends to continue selectively animates European allies into action. The date to watch is May 15th, when the review is scheduled for completion. The tone and outcome of that review will be a crucial indicator of U.S. intent.
Okay, Section 301 review May 15th. And now let's talk about the rise of corporate intelligence layers and the revaluation of assets. Block's revenue tripled in 2 years, hitting $30 billion. Slack and Salesforce didn't grow that fast. It's not just software, it's like someone realized the entire corporate asset base needed a rethink.
Stepping back, they're essentially redesigning the organization around an intelligence layer powered by AI, replacing traditional management hierarchies with a system that proactively automates decisions. It's a shift from humans coordinating information to an AI reacting to the economic graph of its users' transactions.
So no product roadmaps. Like the backlog isn't a bunch of executives guessing what people want.
The failure of the AI to compose a solution is the roadmap. Block is driving development based on actual customer financial behavior, not internal speculation. This is enabled by a continuous world model of operations and customer interactions, where speed as a compounding advantage is paramount.
A world model? Sounds ambitious. What's fueling this thing?
The honest signal of financial transactions. Block has a dual view of buyer and seller data through Cash App and Square. That richness is unavailable to competitors who rely on self-reported information. Close proximity to end users, as Matthew McLennan pointed out, creates regenerative feedback loops enabling continuous improvement, effectively building a royalty on essential services.
A royalty? Like Becton Dickinson, the medical supply company.
The analogy is apt. McLennan frames their value as an eclectic royalty portfolio, capturing small but essential shares of economic activity. Becton Dickinson's enduring value comes from this feedback loop. Proximity to patients drives continuous technological improvement. Modest growth, enduring value. It's a hidden causal mechanism most investors miss.
Okay, so Block is building a feedback loop. That sounds good. What's the catch?
Conventional valuation metrics are increasingly disconnected from economic reality. Private equity portfolios are exhibiting a two-quarter echo effect, where market changes materialize in valuations with a quantifiable lag. This means current NAV forecasts often miss crucial adjustments in manager judgment.
A two-quarter echo. So everyone's looking at old data.
Essentially, it creates room for mispricing and systemic risk. And that disconnect is compounded by the subtle rebranding of shadow banking as private credit after 2008.
Subtly, Tracy Alauv only noticed it last year. That's concerning.
It's a telling detail. It effectively insulated risky lending from regulatory oversight. The migration of risk is happening beneath the surface.
Wonderful. Is there any good news?
Constraints are building within critical AI infrastructure. Insurers are reaching their capacity to cover data center risk. That's a fundamental limit on continued expansion.
So even the AI boom has an insurance limit. It's like trying to ensure everyone suddenly decides to learn to fly. Eventually, the risk pool is just too big.
A fitting analogy. This coincides with Gulf states increasingly reliant on private borrowing to fund fiscal commitments as high oil prices undermine their economies.
Oh, so it's a geopolitical issue too.
So here's the picture. It creates a funding gap. MicroStrategy's substantial Bitcoin-backed debt lacks practical hedging mechanisms, mirroring pre-2008 structures funded by continued asset appreciation. Despite this, U.S. markets demonstrate unexpectedly high tolerance for geopolitical risk.
That tolerance is that just because the economy keeps chugging along?
To a large extent, yes. Value is increasingly defined by the transformation of electrons to tokens and the value assigned to those tokens. NVIDIA, for example, isn't merely a chip manufacturer. They're structuring their business around increasing the value of tokens.
So hardware is secondary?
Competitors focused solely on hardware are more vulnerable. It's a fundamental shift in value creation. Apollo Asset Management aiming for $1 trillion AUM by year-end 2026 and $1.5 trillion by 2029 isn't driven by capital inflow, but sourcing high-quality investment products during market dislocation.
Dislocation hasn't materialized yet. Jim Zelter said that in April 2026.
Correct. Despite the headlines, the potential for value creation remains unrealized. These dynamics underscore a critical shift in competitive advantage. Success increasingly depends on picking the best environment for agents.
So it's not about the model, it's about the setup.
Two things stand out. Firms building feedback loops that prioritize the honest signal of real-world transactions will outperform. But their valuations won't be fully captured by traditional metrics. The market currently misprices the velocity of this transition, prioritizing continued AUM growth and overlooking systemic risk masked by the delayed echo effect and limitations in AI infrastructure capacity.
By year-end 2026, the ability to reliably generate these honest signals will define organizational resilience. And increasingly abstract tokens will face scrutiny from a landscape lacking adequate risk mitigation. It's optimistic to say the least.
The core issue is that traditional financial modeling relies on historical patterns. The speed and interconnectedness of AI-driven markets are creating conditions where those patterns are rapidly becoming irrelevant. This misalignment, coupled with the constraints in risk infrastructure, creates a potentially volatile environment.
So we're basically building a really complex system on a foundation of assumptions that are already crumbling. And the thing most likely to break first is the insurance industry. And we think of insurance as a stable pillar. That's reassuring. The current obsession with defining value through the transformation of electrons to tokens feels a lot like pre-2008 housing, a self-reinforcing cycle where appreciation drives further investment, masking underlying vulnerabilities. You know what I noticed this week? Grant Thornton generates about $100,000 in revenue per employee. Onshore, a million. That's a difference.
It's a tenfold productivity gain, and it's not an isolated case. This disparity isn't about better people, it's about compute, and it signals a fundamental restructuring of profitability models. The U.S. government recognizes this, mobilizing resources at a scale comparable to the post-9/11 boom, but with a crucial distinction, they're absorbing private sector innovation rather than developing it internally.
So instead of building a better bomb, they're just buying a lot of really good software.
Aram Gavor points out that previous technologies like nuclear physics were government-led. AI requires integrating an externally developed innovation, which creates a demand signal to industry. But this approach has a side effect. It's accelerating the obsolescence of existing analytical capabilities. Forecasts suggest senior professional roles are disappearing within 4 to 5 years.
That's inconvenient for the people currently in those roles.
It is.
This erosion of human capital is concentrating wealth at the point of computation. Firms like Deloitte and KPMG are struggling to justify their cost structure when AI-assisted firms are achieving these productivity levels. Tom Blomfield predicts this trend will lead to income tax replacement by a compute tax within 5 to 6 years, funding welfare programs by taxing data centers and inference tokens.
A compute tax? Just tax the machines. That's the logical conclusion, isn't it?
It appears to be.
But it doesn't translate to economic stability, at least not immediately. AI uniquely concentrates existing grievances, job displacement anxiety, visible wealth concentration, and existential risk rhetoric, creating a volatile environment for political disruption.
A perfect cauldron, you could say.
A fitting description.
In the US, focus on the cost of AI development sharply contrasts with other nations' strategies. India, for example, is committing to as-needed AI funding directly supported by the Prime Minister, fostering an agile development environment.
As needed. That sounds flexible.
It is.
This sustained funding, combined with a focus on deploying AI solutions for challenges specific to the Global South, tuberculosis diagnosis, agriculture, education, encourages rapid iteration. They're prioritizing practical application over theoretical perfection.
So they're building with AI, not just studying its potential ramifications.
And India is deliberately positioning itself as a distinct third pole in global AI governance, diverging from both the US carrot and stick approach and China's sphere of influence model. Abhishek Singh explicitly states India aims for an Indian way rather than mirroring either American or Chinese approaches, pursuing an operational strategy through the UN framework.
Sounds ambitious.
And NVIDIA actively shapes this ecosystem through investment, partnerships, and education of partners. Their scale isn't just a show of force, it's a deliberate effort to facilitate downstream-upstream visibility and shared understanding of AI's trajectory.
JTC is a class.
In a sense.
Jensen Huang explicitly links AI model performance to the underlying hardware stack, believing that models optimized for NVIDIA architecture perform best on NVIDIA hardware. He frames alternative architectures, Huawei, for instance, as a horrible outcome for the United States.
So it's not just about the chips themselves, then?
Not at all. Upscale AI's $2 billion valuation, despite having no revenue, demonstrates the leverage inherent in efficient chip-to-chip communication. OpenPilot's success, achieved by bypassing cutting-edge machine learning through efficient inter-process communication, reinforces that point.
So the plumbing matters more than the algorithm?
Increasingly, yes.
Generative AI deployment isn't a one-time integration, but a continuous cycle of refinement, driving an 861% increase in code churn among high AI adoption companies, 9.4 times higher than non-AI users. Anthropic's revenue growth now correlates directly with its clients' capacity for ongoing internal adaptation, shifting AI from a fixed product to a perpetual subscription.
That's a lot of code changes, 861%.
It's a critical metric.
This relentless code churn reveals a need for constant, rigorous oversight, and that's where European quantitative funds are discovering the problem of overfitting. CFM's adoption of metamodels to detect it illustrates a broader trend.
Metamodels. That sounds complicated.
But the pursuit of operational rigor stems from a common intellectual ancestry, systems initially developed by physicists at Oxford and Cambridge, where repeatable costs historically outweighed performance randomness. They emphasize consistency over chasing peak performance.
Physicists, of course.
The recent market rally driven by AI-driven trading, 12 stocks hitting 52-week highs while the S&P 500 reaches all-time highs, masks a broader weakness. Trading skill now exceeds fundamental investment in value creation.
It's less about building better companies and more about predicting which companies will briefly go up.
Essentially,
in future, AI dominance won't be won by those who build the best models, but by those who can most efficiently maintain them, demanding a sustained flow of skilled engineers and pervasive computational infrastructure that alters national revenue streams. This isn't about building the AI, it's about the constant upkeep.
Which means?
It means Travis Kalanick was right about organizational inertia. The scale of code churn, the need for continuous adaptation, and the focus on repeatable operational rigor reveal that the capacity to maintain and refine these systems is paramount.
It's not about the initial spark of genius, but the endless cycle of tweaking and adjusting. A 9.4 times increase in code churn is a lot of babysitting.
There's a signal here. The success of this endeavor hinges on constant, rigorous oversight, demanding a sustained flow of skilled engineers and pervasive computational infrastructure, and fundamentally altering how we think about national economic value. The companies that can maintain these systems efficiently and reliably will dictate the future, not necessarily those that built the initial models.
7 million barrels of oil a day. That's the current disruption level, right? A number that feels underreported given the potential fallout.
And the key takeaway isn't necessarily the price impact, though that's significant, currently a geopolitical risk premium of $5 to $10 per barrel, but the systematic reshaping of the energy order. We're seeing a deliberate strategy of inventory depletion, not a shock like COVID, where Adam Farstrup points out tanker orders are lagging actual need. This isn't about maximizing revenue in the short term, it's about control.
Control orchestrated by whom exactly? The narrative frames Iran as unusually prepared, almost expecting this.
It's a fundamental shift in doctrine. Iran views some degree of uranium enrichment as non-negotiable, a bedrock principle for regime survival. Initial U.S. assessments overlooked this entirely, assuming a more conventional response. They've planned for this, accepting economic hardship, a 95% daily shipping drop, according to HSBC's data, as a cost of doing business.
Calculated self-sabotage in pursuit of leverage. That sounds expensive.
It is, but consider the alternative. They've decentralized leadership and actively sought external support, specifically from Russia for intelligence and critically China for missile technology. This mitigates the impact of external strikes and maintains operational capacity. More importantly, China's clandestine provision of a satellite to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps fundamentally altered Tehran's risk calculus, enabling decentralized command and control.
A satellite? That's a game changer. It's like giving a chess player a second board to visualize moves, isn't it?
That's a useful analogy. The pre-war risk calculations were entirely different before that asset. It allowed Iran to disrupt those 7 million barrels of daily exports despite its weaknesses, effectively pioneering a new form of choke point warfare with limited strikes by cheap drones and missiles. Mariners are self-sanctioning because of the perceived risk, reshaping trade routes proactively.
Proactively reshaping trade routes, Amrita Sen calls it a level of denial among macro traders. They're still anticipating a negotiated resolution, aren't they?
The pattern is clear. Sen highlights that they consistently believe there will be a resolution because the alternative is just too difficult to fathom. This blinds them to the substantial supply shocks that were, in her words, already done. There's a consistent underestimation of Tehran's strategic planning, a fact Maloney underscores.
So optimism is the vulnerability.
In this case, yes.
The perceived stability of the Gulf region, critical for attracting capital, has fractured. This reveals a foundational vulnerability predicated on avoiding regional war, and that shift in risk perception threatens gains in sectors like real estate and technology. It's not just about oil, it's about the entire ecosystem that depends on predictable energy flows.
Predictable energy flows. Chetan Ahia suggests we need to model oil shocks differently now, include supply shortages alongside price increases.
Worth noting, that drives a downward revision of Asia's growth forecasts, now projected at 4.4% instead of 4.8%. The IMF anticipates downgrading global growth forecasts, reflecting the broad economic impact beyond the Middle East. The entire system is recalibrating.
Recalibrating toward what? A new baseline for energy prices.
The implication runs deeper. Iran is establishing a new baseline, prepared to endure economic pain to achieve long-term dominance. They're essentially collecting a tax on oil shipments passing through the Strait of Hormuz, a scenario previously considered unthinkable. This capacity for asymmetric warfare relies on the convergence of Russian intelligence, Chinese technology, and a security bureaucracy willing to act opportunistically.
Opportunistically? Like Israel's relationship with Hamas. Maintaining a workable status quo, even funding them through Qatar to avoid broader intervention.
It's a similar logic. Strategically maintaining a controlled instability to secure wider objectives. Israel's continued expansionist agenda, specifically regarding the West Bank, Gaza, and southern Lebanon, requires almost unlimited American support, not just financial aid, but the military scale necessary to maintain escalation dominance over a population of 500 million people, as Telhami frames it.
Escalation dominance. A nice phrase. So both sides are willing to accept calculated risk.
To achieve their primary goals, Iran successfully implemented a plan from the outset, regime survival and gaining leverage. The assumption that they were caught off guard in June 2025 proved incorrect, highlighting a consistent underestimation of their preparedness.
Okay, so we're betting that Iranian leadership will accept incremental gains and a symbolic enrichment program in exchange for sustained control of the world's most critical energy choke point.
That's the current market expectation. But the crucial point is this isn't a short-term crisis, it's a lasting shift. The dynamic signals a new strategic environment where energy supply is increasingly tied to political concessions and a willingness to accept calibrated risk. We are witnessing a fundamental realignment of power.
Calibrated risk, so let's say this holds and Iran maintains control through, say, 2027. What happens when the initial ceasefire agreements begin to unravel? If we start seeing a wider escalation of proxy conflicts, will we see a global jet fuel shortage, a complete collapse of the Australian diesel supply, and ultimately a resurgence of barter economies? Looking back at the week of April 13th, 18th, 2026, it feels less like a collection of events and more like observing the foundations of a new world order being deliberately, if cautiously, reshaped. We started with the US recalibrating its foreign policy, opting for economic pressure over direct intervention, a calculated shift, but one riddled with assumptions about the resilience of the system. And that's where it all began to connect. Because this isn't just about Iran or China, it's about the very mechanisms of power in a world increasingly defined by data and access to the compute capacity needed to process it.
What we've seen this week is the interconnectedness of these forces accelerating. The $100 billion monthly flow into state bank interventions isn't an anomaly. It's the system attempting to maintain a facade of stability as underlying valuations are dynamically, and often discordantly, repriced by these world models we discussed. Block's revenue tripling to $30 billion, that's not just a company succeeding. It's a signal of capital migrating to entities that can operate within and potentially around the constraints of traditional finance. It's almost like we're watching a parallel financial system emerge, one where honest signals of customer behavior trump internal forecasting, creating a constant tension.
And Iran's deliberate acceptance of economic pain, 7 million barrels of oil a day disrupted, a $5 to $10 risk premium on crude, that's a crucial data point. It's a textbook playbook of asymmetric warfare, but played out on an energy scale, specifically to gain leverage over compute access and establish their position in this new framework. It feels less like brinkmanship and more like an investment in future control. You touched on it earlier, Alex, describing this as a stained glass window held together by willpower and strategically placed tape, but this week that tape feels thinner.
The data tells a story. The speed of code churn, 861% increase among high AI adoption companies, is a stark indicator of how quickly this revaluation process is unfolding and how reliant everyone is becoming on these predictive models. And what Maya rightly pointed out about the distortion of economic indicators, we're potentially seeing a deliberate attempt to prioritize stock market performance over genuine economic health. The Section 301 review, scheduled for completion May 15th, will be critical in revealing how committed the U.S. is to selectively animating European allies in this increasingly fragmented landscape. Apollo's AUM targets, $1 trillion by year-end, $1.5 trillion by 2029, show where capital sees long-term advantage.
But all this raises a fundamental question: for how long can this work? What happens when the discrepancies become too great? Are we genuinely prepared for analytical roles becoming obsolete within 4 to 5 years?
That's the million-no-trillion-dollar question. The looming shift toward a compute tax within 5 to 6 years suggests a recognition that data is the new currency, but it also raises huge questions about access, equity, and the potential for further disruption. And India's divergence pursuing its own AI governance path adds another layer of complexity. We'll be watching closely to see if the Indian way offers an alternative to the US-China duopoly.
So for next week, keep a close eye on the Section 301 review and watch for any cracks in the consensus narrative around economic stability. We'll be digging deeper into the implications of this accelerating decoupling of market value from reality and whether this is truly insane, but working, or heading towards a more significant correction.
We'll also continue tracking the geopolitical competition for compute, especially as it relates to emerging supply chain vulnerabilities and the potential for unexpected escalation. Until then, stay vigilant. The tectonic plates are still very much in motion, and the feints and parries are only just beginning.